Welcome to Mostly Books Meets. I'm Sarah.
I'm Imogen.
And I'm Lindsay.
And together we are the team at Mostly Books, an award-winning independent bookshop. In this podcast series, we'll be speaking to authors, journalists, poets, and a range of professionals from the world of publishing. We'll be asking about the books that are special to them, from childhood favourites to the book that changed their life. And we hope you'll join us for the journey. Hi, it's Sarah. This week, I'm talking to Ross Welford, one of the most critically acclaimed middle grade authors in the UK. Ross's debut children's novel, Time Travelling with a Hamster, was published in 2015, and he's gone on to publish a further five middle grade books, the latest of which, When We Got Lost in Dreamland, was published in January this year. His books have been translated into over 15 languages, and he's been shortlisted for some of the UK's most prestigious children's book prizes, including the Costa and the Blue Peter Book Award. Ross, welcome to Mostly Books Meets.
Hello, Sarah. Lovely to be here.
It's really wonderful to have you here. Your books are a firm favourite in our shop, and we always have them in stock. They're a very easy hand sell, I have to say. What's not to love about the well-written fiction with a bit of magical mystery stuff thrown in?
Oh, well, that's nice to know.
Let's start off by going back to your childhood. You were born and raised in Cullercoats.
That's right, in the lovely northeast of England, yeah.
Perfect. What do you remember about your childhood?
Well, I mean, I was blessed with a happy, comfortable upbringing with a stable family, you know. Cullercoats, very close to Whitney Bay. And back then, back in the 60s and 70s, it was still recognisably a holiday destination. You know, it was a resort. The bay itself was, you know, there was a fairground and penny arcades and things like that. And during the summer, it was really, really busy. You know, it was fun. It was a fun place. And people would go to the beach. And, you know, we used to go down swimming, God, in the North Sea.
A lot more robust as children.
We loved it. It was great. It's a lot quieter now. But, you know, it's still a lovely part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. What's not to love as a child, having access to all of that as well as the sea. So did you read a lot as a child?
Yeah. I mean, I was very lucky. I've got three older brothers and sisters, so I had a house full of books and I could read pretty fluently before I started school. And yeah, it was books at bedtime. I mean, my mum, with four kids, my mum was pretty relieved when I learned to read on my own. Relieved her of the duty of doing bedtime stories. And yeah, she was very happy to just leave me to get on with reading myself. My dad would come in sometimes from work and read us. His favourites were poems from A.A. Milne, yeah, when Now We Are Six.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I was never interrupted if I had a book in my hand, pretty much. I was a keen reader.
Were you one of those kids that had the torch under the duvet or under the blanket?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I was lucky enough we had tiny, but to me it was huge when I was little. It was a little local branch library, and it's still there, the Cullercoats branch library.
Oh, lovely.
About the size of my front room now, and I got through everything in their kids section.
It's funny, I've been speaking to an awful lot of people, and we've been doing quite a lot of recordings in the last couple of weeks for this series, and the theme of libraries just keeps coming up again and again, and it's just the thing that we reiterate to everyone as booksellers how important those libraries are. And probably preaching to the converted if people are in our shop buying books.
Yeah.
But the magic of the library is definitely a thing.
Don't as a bookseller, don't you want to say, don't go to the libraries, come and buy them instead?
Do you know, we've actually been told that there's research been done that towns that have got active libraries, the bookshops in those towns actually sell more books. Which seems a bit counterintuitive, but I guess I understand it. People, if they read, then they're going to want to read wherever they can get hold of the book.
Yeah. Good news. Great.
Yeah, win-win.
Yeah.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Well, I had to think hard about this one. It was almost certainly an Enid Blyton, and I think it was probably the Faraway Tree stories. I absolutely loved them, and I still do. I reread them to my children when they were little, and yeah, I mean, I think probably the first one I actually remember was something dull like the Little Red Hen. You know, school primer. But yeah, actually storybooks, it'll have been the Faraway Tree stories. They're great. I dipped into it the other day because I just need to refresh my memory. And yeah, I mean, it's such a cool and simple idea that at the top of a magical tree, there was a magical land that changed every now and then. I mean, what a great idea that is.
Do you know, I'm embarrassed to say, as a bookseller and a massive book fiend, I read a lot of Enid Blyton's as a child, but I never read The Magic Faraway Tree.
Oh.
Isn't that funny? And we have it in the shop, and I always swear I should read it, and I haven't.
Yeah. I thoroughly recommend it. But obviously, they've changed it around a little bit now. To keep Enid Blyton relevant to kids these days, they have changed one or two little elements. Well, you can cut this out. The two of the kids, rather unfortunately these days, were called Dick and Fanny. So they're now called Rick and Franny, which I think for parents everywhere is such a relief, you know. And
I don't want to cut that out.
there's one of the baddies, one of the people that they come across in one of the lands, is called something like Dame Slap-a-Lot, who goes around slapping naughty children. And quite understandably, they've adapted that for the times.
They don't want to encourage that kind of behaviour.
You know, and I can completely get behind that. And certainly, if I was the owner of the Enid Blyton estate, I'd be thinking, well, yeah, anything to keep my books being sold.
We do feel like there's like a constant stream of them, to be perfectly honest. We are regularly getting updates in the Blyton Library, so that works. It works for us, it works for publishers as well. So.
Back then, you know, she attracted a lot of the same sort of opprobrium as David Williams gets now. But she was popular just as David Williams is. Perhaps not great literature, but my goodness me, it kept me reading. And I read practically everything she put out.
I think Enid Blyton's an example for an awful lot of people of the first author, where you discover an author and then because you know that author's good, you then carry on reading them.
Yeah.
I certainly discovered that. I felt like that as a child, and I've heard that from quite a few people I've spoken to. Which, you know, she just had such an array of different books. Then it gets you hooked.
Yeah, it really, really does. Really does. And such good plots. She was really good with plots. In fact, so good, she wasn't scared to reuse them several times. She's like, blimey, I'll have that one again. You know, you notice that if you're reading things like Secret Seven and Famous Thing. Okay, here we are again. No, I never noticed that as a kid. You know?
No. No, you don't, do you? So after finishing school, you went to university, and after graduating, you moved to London to become a journalist. You did that for a few years before heading into TV production. Where I was amazed when I read your bio.
Uh-huh.
The TV programmes you produced were some of my absolute favourites.
Oh, really? Oh, good.
The Big Breakfast.
Yeah.
I watched it religiously. I loved it.
Oh, right. Oh, good. Good, good. Yeah, it was a fun time, really. I mean, things like The Big Breakfast, I have to say, they were more fun to watch than they were to make.
I bet.
The Big Breakfast was a hard show to make. It was a big team, a very, very, very early start and very, very demanding. But I'm glad I did it. I mean, very often, night before we went on air, I think we went on air at 7 a.m. And you would usually work through the night, finish the script at about 2 or something. And then we'd catch a cab up to the production house. And, you know, the bed where Paula did her interviews,
mm-hmm.
it was actually just a pile of packing crate with a thin mattress.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They had a thin mattress on top. You know, I'd sleep on that for a couple of hours before getting up, brushing my teeth and starting the show. And then, that day, you'd be done by 10 a.m. Yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, it looked like it was a lot of fun. But like I said, I mean, I'd written down here anyway before we were speaking. All I think about is it must be hard work. Because I think, like you say, as the viewer, there was so much going on that to try, I can't even imagine what that must have been like to put it all together. How did you get involved in that?
In The Big Breakfast or TV particularly?
TV production as a whole.
Well, the magazine that I ended up working for when I started off was a magazine about the television industry. It was a trade magazine, a business mag for TV world. And I'd sort of squeezed the pips out of that, and I wanted to go and work in television proper. And so I had a couple of contacts through writing about the industry. So I put the feelers out and ended up getting my first job. I was a researcher on a show called The Time, The Place at Penn's Television. And that was a daily discussion show on ITV, morning show, sort of a rival to Kilroy, if you remember that, in the early 90s.
Yeah.
So from there, I went on to, you know, do other sort of tended to be daily lifestyle or live shows.
So it kept life varied.
Yeah.
And at what point in your career did you decide that you'd like to write a book, and did something particular happen, trigger that decision?
Yeah, I've stayed in TV for a while, and it was good fun. But by the time, as a family, we all moved to Sweden. My wife is Swedish, and she got a great job at a Swedish bank. And so we all moved out there. I couldn't work as a TV producer there because I don't speak Swedish. So I was kind of unemployed. And, I'd say I was unemployed. That's not fair. I was a full-time dad, two twins, which was the best job I've ever had, of course. I loved it. But I did find myself, once the kids were off at school, I did find myself with a lot of time on my hands in a strange country. Thought I had no more excuses now. I might as well start to write. I'd always had the idea that I might write a book or do something like that. But quite rightly, I thought that's going to be really hard work. It's much, much easier not to write than to write. But I ran out of excuses, really. So yeah, I started to write this idea that I had kicking about in my head for ages, which was the time travel one.
So it just developed naturally and then pen to paper and came to that. It wasn't...
Yeah, pretty much. I'd done, as a few years before then, I'd done a part-time MA in screenwriting at the City University. And that was 2 years as a part-time MA because I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to write movies or something. And I didn't end up writing movies. But what it did, that sort of opened my eyes a little bit to the possibilities of using my own imagination, I suppose. Because you know, you have to write stuff on an MA screenwriting. I ended up with writing a movie that's now sitting in my bottom drawer untouched.
Oh!
I still keep meaning to go back to it. I still think, there's quite a good story in it. But it kind of opened my eyes. I thought, I could possibly be able to do this making it all up business.
It's amazing, actually, isn't it? Just how transferable that kind of thing is. You go and thinking maybe one thing, and then you end up applying the skills to something completely different.
Yeah.
Your first book, you say, Time Traveling with a Hamster, was published, and it was extremely well received. Mm. How did you find that as a debut author? How was the experience?
It's a good question. I didn't know what to expect. If you'd said to me when I was writing it, well, you know what, we'll find a small imprint that's going to run 1,000 copies, you'll be a published author, you'd have bitten your arm off. Mm-hmm. Wow, what? I'm going to have a book published. So when it rapidly escalated into getting an agent and it being sold to HarperCollins and being Waterstone's Book of the Month and everything, which really was a hell of a beginning.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't believe it. It was wonderful. But being new to the whole industry, I suppose there was an element of me that was wondering, well, is this normal? Well, is this what happens to every new book? It gets immediately picked up by a big publisher and becomes an instant bestseller and everything. I did take a couple of calls from a publisher who was trying very politely to say, you know, Ross, this isn't normal. Don't get used to this. You know? But don't expect this to happen every time. But I was, very fortunate that one, it really did launch my career. They wanted another one and another one and another one and so on.
So how long did it take you to write the first book, and then how long did you have to write the second? I'm always interested in this question because I think once you're published, the time frames change significantly, don't they?
Yeah, I know. It definitely, it's a lot different once you're published. The first one took me 2 or 3 years in the making, from very first sentence to getting it out in the shop. I wrote about a quarter of it, then we ended up coming back to England and I had a quarter written, and that had taken me about 6 months. I had about a quarter written and I was feeling a little bit tail between my legs because I hadn't finished it. And a friend of mine recommended that I enroll on an adult ed course, which was being run in conjunction with an American program called NaNoWriMo, which is short for National Novel Writing Month. And the idea is that you pledge to write a first draft in a month. It's the sort of don't get it right, get it written approach. Mm-hmm. You just don't, for 1 month, you write 1,500 words a day or whatever, even of rubbish, but you end up with the first draft. So I did that. And I ended up with a sort of 50,000-60,000 word first draft, which was awful. But over the next few months, I rewrote it, and by the following spring, I had it into something that I thought was possibly worth showing around. You know, I thought, yeah, this is not so bad.
And then did you just go out to agents with that?
Yeah, well, I'm really bad at self-publicity, Sarah. So I sent it out to one or two agents and had it sent back. But there was one agent that kept sitting on it, and I kept chasing him. And eventually he said, I'm going to hand this over to a colleague of mine. And of course, I thought, okay, well, that's the polite way of saying...
Thanks, but no thanks.
Yeah, thanks, but no thanks. A couple of weeks after that, his colleague called me back, said, my name is Sylvia. I work for Peter Fraser and Dunlop. I've just read your book and I really love it and I want to take you on as a client.
Amazing.
Wow. So by then it was the November. That was the greatest phone call I've ever taken in my life, you know, because a few months after that, she had sold it to HarperCollins.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. Well, then the rest of the HarperCollins, I've never written anything like that before. So there was, they wanted a new ending.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. The ending that we have now in Time Time Brewing with a Hamster, which I think is, I love it, but it's a happy ending. And the ending that I'd been sending out was very, very logical, and it worked absolutely, but it was very downbeat. And they said, they said, look, we'll publish it this way if you really, really want. But if you want to sell a lot, I recommend that this is for 10-year-olds. I recommend you give it a happy ending. So I tried a couple more endings until we ended up with the one that we have now. And I'm so glad we did.
Good advice. Brilliant. So fast forward to today. Mm. You live in London with your wife and children, and you just published your sixth book.
Yeah.
When We Got Lost in Dreamland. What's this book about?
Well, this is my most ambitious one, I think. And I always say this, but I do think this one is my favourite. This is about two young brothers, Malky and Seb, 11 and 7. They acquire each a mysterious device called a Dreaminator, which is something that you hang over your bed, and it allows you not only to direct and have whatever dreams you like, control your dreams, but you can share them. And Malky and Seb end up sharing their dreams. And it's all really, really good fun at first. But it's the nature of these things that something goes horribly wrong. And Seb ends up stuck in his dream. In real life, he is in a coma. Doctors don't know what to do. They can't wake him up. And it's only Malky knows where he is. He is stuck in dreamland. He's a prisoner of some Stone Age warriors. And Malky has to go back into this dangerous dreamland to rescue his brother.
Amazing. Where did the idea of the story come from?
Do you know what? Disappointingly, I can't remember.
Oh, no!
I know, but I usually can. I don't know. I think I must have read an article or seen something on TV about lucid dreaming, which is a thing. And very often I see things like that, and I was like, oh, gosh, there might be a story in that somewhere. And I'll just sort of park it somewhere in the back of my head. And then when it comes around to thinking up a new idea, I'll just sift through these ideas and go, oh, okay, can I do something with that? Could I do something with that? And I ended up reading a little bit around lucid dreaming and wondering how I could get these boys or this kid, I didn't even know who the cast was then, how I could get them into this situation. And my thoughts turned to dream catchers. Do you remember those things?
Yeah.
I think some people still have them, those decorative things. And I thought, dream catchers. And so I fiddled around with that for a while and turned a dream catcher into a Dreaminator. And just kept writing. Usually the way I find a story is just to start off with something and just to write and write and write.
Just evolves naturally.
Mm,
How have you found the experience of writing this book versus the others? Has it felt different for each book, or are you fairly consistent with the way you do it?
No, it's hell every time. Every time I think, oh no, this is going to be the one where I get found out, where I get found out to be a talentless fraud. It takes a long time, usually the period between submitting the final draft and the book coming out. It'll take a while. I'll be convinced in that period that this is just awful. Everyone's going to hate it. And then by the time I have the book in my hand, a few weeks later, and I start flicking through it, and I think, oh, that bit's quite nice. Oh, I like that. Oh, maybe this one. Maybe I'll do another one. Yeah.
And so the cycle begins again.
Yes, exactly.
Why did you decide to write children's books in particular?
I didn't really. I had this idea for a time travel story. And at the time I had, when I started writing it, my kids were probably about 10. I have twins, and they were probably about 10. And I thought, oh, yeah, it'll be nice to write a book that they can read. I suppose. And at the time, when Time Travelling with a Hamster was written in my head, I knew nothing about children's publishing. I thought YA, young adult, I thought, oh, that was the big thing. That's the new genre. I'll write a YA book. Not knowing anything about it, not knowing that you can't have an 11-year-old protagonist, really, in a YA book. And so when HarperCollins came back to me and said, yeah, we're pitching this at middle grade, I was going, what's middle grade? I just knew nothing about it. I was a little bit surprised that they were pitching it so young. It now makes total sense. And there were a couple of jokes and a couple of swear words I had to take out, but I didn't have to change it all that much to make it suitable for middle grade. And then they wanted another one, and after two books I found myself as a children's writer.
I do think that middle grade fiction is one of the most delightful areas of bookselling, because it is the point where children's books are really kind of going from being really quite young to they're starting to develop, and they're getting some really interesting complex ideas in them.
Yes, isn't it exciting?
Oh, it's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah,
the range of choice in that genre is brilliant.
And then particularly at the moment, there are so many good books around for 10-year-olds, which they're not just for 10, 11-year-olds. There's some really, really good books out there that are good reads for people people of any age.
Yeah, we're all massive fans of them in the shop. It's one of my favourite parts of the job, having to read children's.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, also, you know, they get to the point, you know, they have good, strong characters, and there's no messing about in middle grade. You've got to start your story off with a bang and keep it moving, because 10-year-olds are not stupid. They're not going to stick around for chapter after chapter of digressive description.
Yep, that's totally right. All your books have a hint of magic or kind of fantasy realism in them.
Mm.
Now, that shouldn't be a huge surprise, because you were invited to join the Magic Circle in 2019. Mm. That's fascinating for me. Have you always been interested?
I mean, that all goes back to, you know, when I was very small again, you know, reading Enid Blyton at the same time as that. I was getting into magic tricks and had a magic set, like loads of kids have magic sets. They learn the trick that works straight out of the box or something with a tricky bit of gadgetry, and they learn that and they think that's fun, and most kids stop that. I was fascinated with actually learning the performance of it, and perhaps, you know, the more difficult bits of it. It's a love that stayed with me all my life, performing and just being interested in magic tricks. And it wasn't until my second book, until I wrote Invisible, that I realized that there was a theme in my writing that was similar to a magic trick. You know, it's presenting something, the stories that I write are presenting something impossible, like time travel or invisibility or immortality or whatever. It's something impossible, but it's happening in the real world. It's a bit like presenting a magic trick. And so now I find it a little bit easier, if you like, to think of the ideas, because I think, well, what would be impossible and how would that play out in the real world? And so, yeah, the two things come together. But I do, yeah, I still like doing, magic tricks. They don't work so well on a podcast, I'm afraid.
I know, I'm so disappointed. Maybe one day we'll get you along to an event, and if that happens, see you do a trick. So we're recording this during the third national lockdown, and the joys of the corona.
The third, fourth, fifth, I've lost count.
Yeah, it's ongoing, and we're all having to deal with incredibly strange times with COVID and the pandemic across the world.
Yeah.
Normally, when you publish a book, you would be, and as part of your job as a whole, you'd be out and about, you'd be going to schools, you'd be going to festivals, you'd be meeting your readers. This year is obviously a very different feel. Yeah. How have you adjusted to how things are this last year?
Oh, well, I mean, just the same as everybody else, really, just by gritting your teeth and getting on with it. You're right. I mean, normally now, in fact, doing this chat with you, as part of the book's promotion, I'd very often be out going around schools and visiting classrooms and everything. And I do miss that. It's one of the great joys of being a middle grade writer, is that I can get out and actually talk to the people who read my book. And it's such a joy to going into schools and going into classrooms. And, you know, I have a big show in which, you know, I do magic. I do book-related magic and talk about my books, and I write stories with the kids, and we do a little workshop, and I mean, it's huge fun, and I do love doing it, but that's all off the cards at the moment. I'm doing a few online virtual shows, but, you know, you can understand that most schools have got enough on their plates without trying to organise even a virtual author visit. Even that takes time and an organisation, which, you know, a lot of schools, well, they, you know, they have other priorities at the moment, I think.
Mm. Yeah, we're certainly finding that. We're currently planning for World Book Day, which is obviously normally a really big time of year for the shop. And we'd normally do probably 8 or so events over the course of a week with authors and book fairs. And like you say, schools have just said, you know what, this year it's just not something we can do.
Yeah.
And it's a shame, but we're looking forward to when we'll be able to all do that again.
Exactly. Oh, I'm dying to get back into schools and everything, and it you know, it is something that I've missed, but, you know, it is what it is. We'll get back to it, and I look forward to that.
Yes, absolutely. So a lot of people are turning to books at the moment. They've had a bit more time at home, maybe they're not traveling for work, whereas other people find they're unable to read, they're unable to concentrate. Which camp are you falling in?
I've never found it a problem to read, really, you know. I do, secretly, I'm taking great pleasure in, sometimes, I mean, I really do miss going out and going to the pub and stuff like that. But being able to stay in and read, if you're a reader, that is always, you've always got that compensation.
Mm.
So I've been trying to draw that consolation from it.
What was the last book you read?
Actually, I've just finished rereading. I read it the first time ages ago. Lost Horizon, which was by James Hilton. Mm-hmm. It was published in 1937, and it was a book that introduced the world to the mythical Valley of Shangri-La, which is it's a utopian sort of book, in a way. very mysterious, wonderful sort of book. And I don't know if you know it, the basic story is four Westerners crash land in a hidden valley in Tibet where everything is perfect and people live for hundreds of years. And it's a wonderful book. And I remember reading it about 10 years ago and liking it. And I'm just starting to sketch out plans for my next book. And I thought, wow, do you know what? In these times, we could do with a little optimism. I don't want to write a dystopia. We've had plenty of dystopias recently. I thought, what about writing an optimistic book about perfect world or something like that? And I thought, well, I'll go back and I'll reread Lost Horizon to see if that sparks any thoughts.
Get some inspiration.
It's a wonderful book. I've just found the Amazon Prime TV channel have got the old movie on it. So I'm going to watch that tonight.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So go watch that as well. Yeah. I haven't read the book. It does sound brilliant. So I'll have to add it to my TV.
No, it's great. And they're quite short. It's an easy read. And funny, I was reading about it last night. It was one of the most popular books of the 20th century. It's got a great history behind it. And Camp David, the American presidential holiday home, was originally called Shangri-La. Mm-hmm. Yeah, named after the place in the book.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so cool. Do you always have one book on the go, or are you someone who can read a few concurrently?
That's a good question. Yeah, I can't. Normally there's just one that I'm committed to. If I'm not reading it, I start another one. I always feel a bit disloyal to the one that I've left on the side. You know.
I always like asking the question because I do think it really, people definitely fall in one camp or another.
Yeah.
I also have a theory about books.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that anyone that's a reader will have a book that has had an impact on them, that's changed their life in some way. And that could be professionally, it could be personally.
Yes.
For you as a reader, do you have a book like that? And if so, what is it?
A book that changed my life, it would have to be Wonder by R.J. Palacio.
Fabulous.
Which is a great book, it's a middle grade book. And, well, it was Wonder that encouraged me to write Time Traveling with a Hamster. I'd been kicking around this idea for ages and read Wonder, and I realized that R.J. Palacio was a middle-aged woman writing in the voice of 10-year-old Augie Pullman. It's written in the first person. And I had never, it had never crossed my mind that I would write a middle grade book in the first person as a middle-aged man that I could write as a 10-year-old, you know, in the voice of a 10-year-old. And as soon as I read Wonder, I realized that she'd done it so well. And I started writing Time Traveling with a Hamster in the voice of Al, my protagonist, and I realized that's how I should be writing it. So, yeah.
Goodness. Yeah. So just by reading one book, it gave you that inspiration.
Exactly. That was the book that changed my life. And I still recommend it at all my live shows and everything. Actually, these days I recommend that. Ask the kids to put their hands up who's read it. And very, very often, most of the kids in the room have read it. It's had such an impact.
Yeah, it really is a brilliant book. And it's another one of these kind of timeless ones that you just can't. You're always going to have it as a bookseller. We're always going to have it in the shop or easily accessible.
Yeah.
So, you've got your book, as we said before, When We Got Lost in Dreamland, has just been published.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of all happening. That's all still quite new now. What are your plans for the rest of 2021?
I've got to write another one, Sarah. Yeah, I mean, nobody's going anywhere very soon. I'm still holding out for summer holiday, but come next summer, I should have finished my next one. So, that's what I'm doing, writing number 7.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's nice. So, like I say, I've got nothing else to do, so I might as well get on with it.
Exactly, yeah. Pen to paper before the pubs reopen. Oh, well, I can't wait for that to come. And I really hope that things go well with When We Get Lost in Dreamland.
Thank you.
Another great book.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you. I mean, Ross, it's been brilliant chatting today. Thank you so much for coming on, and I really appreciate you taking the time out.
You're very, very welcome.
And yeah, like I say, best of luck.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thanks. All of the books mentioned during the podcast are available to buy from the Mostly Books website. This podcast has been presented and produced by members of the team at Mostly Books in Abingdon. If you enjoyed what you heard, please rate, review, and subscribe, because apparently it helps people find us.